I'm not just going to dip my toes into the pool. I'm just going to jump in. So I jumped in, came in as a co-founder, and spent the next 6, almost 7 years trying to build the company from scratch. And it was quite an experience. Lots of ups, lots of downs. It took us a while to find some sort of product market fit. It took us a while to figure out how to fundraise effectively, efficiently.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of the second season of Starteando with Iggy. And for this episode, I had the opportunity to have a conversation with Deepa Srivastava. He's in the process of building his third company, and he shared with us the different challenges, lessons he has learned, and skills required to become the entrepreneur that he is today. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And if you would like to support us, the best way to do so is by sharing it with your friends and rating us at the different platforms that you use. Enjoy. Hi, Deepak. Thank you for joining me in this episode of Starteando with Iggy. How are you?
I'm doing so well, Iggy. It's a beautiful morning here in New York. Not as warm as where you are compared to in Colombia, but really happy. And thank you so much for having me on.
No, thank you. I appreciate your time, you joining me to record this episode. I mean, I saw your profile. I've been watching your career and some meetings that you have presented. And yeah, I thought like, this is an amazing story to be shared with people. So yeah, thank you again for your time and for joining me. So Deepak, let me start with the main question of the podcast. Let's go right into it. And the main question of this podcast is, Deepak, how did you end up in the startup world?
Great question. I think everyone has their own individual journey. Mine was extremely non-traditional, right? In the sense that I was never the five-year-old on the corner trying to sell lemonade. I was not a born entrepreneur. I didn't know at a very young age that I wanted to start my own businesses. I took a very prescribed path, right? I come from an immigrant family, immigrated to New York City, grew up here, and the culture was just of one of hustle, right? So work hard in school, do well and get good grades, go to a good college, get good grades, get a good job, and that's sort of the career and the track that one aims for. And that's what I did for a long time. But something clicked at some point where I had left my job at Morgan Stanley in Hong Kong, and this is going back after 10, 11 years being in the workforce. And I knew that it was not, I didn't want to be a cog in the machine, right? I wanted to have some sort of greater impact in my day to day. And I was really lucky enough to start a role early days at Dropbox. And at that time, Dropbox was still very much in growth mode. It wasn't the household name that it is today. And it was such an exciting time to be there. It really was just a risky decision. I could have kept going into finance. I was doing investment banking at the time, could have gotten another similar role, but I just switched gears, got really lucky with joining up with Dropbox and the company being at such an early stage. And I fell in love with the culture, the environment, how unstructured it was, the opportunity to go and do whatever you want to do, right? Just if you want to make an impact, you can make an impact. So I felt the opposite of being a cog in the machine, and I knew that there was no looking back from there on.
Very interesting. When I see that type of experience, that type of change in a profile, like, because you were in Morgan Stanley for more than 8 years, right? What was the thing that attracted you to join Dropbox? At what stage did you join Dropbox, actually?
Yeah, it was, I want to say this was back in 2013, 2012, 2013. I don't even think the company had 100 million users yet. It was still one of those, it was a Silicon Valley darling, don't get me wrong. And I believe it was maybe 100 plus employees, 150, something like that. So it was still very small, very intimate. And by the time I left a year and change afterwards, it was at least double, triple the size. I don't actually recall. But it felt like a new company every couple of weeks, which was tons of fun. The evolution was so fast. So it was just a wonderful time to be there. And even though that was at this point more than 10 years ago, my first startup or early stage tech experience, I still keep in touch with a lot of old friends and colleagues from Dropbox. It's like there's a mini Dropbox mafia out there, which is really fun to continuously engage with out there.
Okay, so you got like the startup bug, right?
100%. Like that was the classic traditional story. Once I was in it, I knew I was in it, and there was no going back.
Yes, and it's very hard to get rid of because of the environment, of the adrenaline rush. Like, at least that is how I see it, how I have experienced it, and how I heard it like before, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
you're absolutely right.
And what happened? Like, what were the main differences that you found initially from this big company, right? To joining this early stage company.
Yeah, I would say there's two big differences. One was, all the positives, the pros that I'm talking about, the ability to sort of navigate yourself and explore and what you're doing in your day-to-day work. You can see the direct tangible impact. But and that's in any role, any team in an early stage company, whether you're on product or sales, something that's more technical or commercial, you always have an ability to make an impact. And I think that's what attracts a lot of, especially top tier talent, to early stage companies. It could be 0 to 1 stage, where my company, Sunrise AI, is at right now, to companies that are a little bit more later on in their story, like when I joined Dropbox, right? But the other noticeable difference that I had was, and it was a really big adjustment and challenging, quite frankly, was having no infrastructure. So what I mean by that is, at a place like Morgan Stanley, a 50,000 person global organization, most of the time, I would say 99.9999% of the time, whatever problem you encounter or roadblock you encounter, there's an extremely high likelihood that someone else in the bank has encountered that problem and they solved it. So there was always some guide or playbook to look towards. There was an existing infrastructure in terms of teams, process that you could always rely on to continue your job and to go stay in your lane and fulfill your mandate. But in an early stage technology company, a lot of the times the problems you're encountering, the roadblocks you're encountering, you're very likely to be the first person to encounter that challenge for that institution in its history. And it was an adjustment to kind of switch gears. Like mentally, I had to shift from, hey, where do I find the answer? Who do I look to? Who do I talk to? What's the right process? Having a source of an established process was something that for a decade plus at Morgan Stanley and roles before that at large corporates, I was just used to. And it was my first time saying, like, oh, actually, I'm in uncharted territory here. I need to actually figure this out myself. And then the added pressure and opportunity to not only figure it out for myself, but then lay the foundation for the next colleague that comes across this situation or problem, they'll refer to what I'm doing right now. And that opportunity to lay that foundation to chart that uncharted territory was both exciting but challenging. And it required me to sort of shift my mental kind of work muscle from the decade previous to the new journey I was on then.
Two very interesting things that attract a specific talent to this environment, right? The direct tangible impact. I think that's something I hear all the time during interviews. I want to have an impact and I want to see it right away, right? I want to see how I'm impacting teams and companies. And also that mental shift that you just shared with us, right? Figuring things out on your own and building the foundation for the next guy. So yeah, interesting, awesome. Yeah, I know. I mean, we could have a whole podcast just about what you did at Dropbox, I can imagine. Right.
It was a lot of
So
fun.
what happened? What happened after that experience, Deepak?
Yeah. I had an opportunity I was based in San Francisco and I had an opportunity to move to New York to help open up the office on behalf of Dropbox. And it was one of the first offices outside of headquarters in San Francisco. I was also one of the first members of the direct sales team, which was the enterprise effort or the initial sort of B2B sales effort that Dropbox was launching at the time. And I realized that, for every dollar in contract that I'm bringing to Dropbox, the likes of Excel, Sequoia, other VCs that had Dropbox that were on Dropbox's cap table, they were marking up their Dropbox positions 10x. So every dollar I bring in, they're upping their valuation of Dropbox by $10, right? So I'm like, maybe I'm in the wrong business. And I, quite frankly, I got inspired to want to do my own thing. Can I go even more early stage? And I happened to come across a mutual friend of mine at the time. She had just moved back from Europe and was starting a company in the travel tech business. I had some experience with travel and hospitality in particular with my previous investment banking tenure. And I knew that I just kind of jumped in. I said, great, she's looking for a co-founder to launch the company with. I said, you know what, let's just take the risk. And I wish I could say that it was a calculated risk, a risk-adjusted decision. My mentality was always extremely quantitative. I studied engineering. I love math. I love physics. It's just the way I make sense of the world. So this type of decision, actually, to stay on the same theme, was another different type of mental shift, right? The decision making was actually more from my heart and a feeling and a gut versus let me calculate how much runway I personally have and what is the opportunity here versus staying at Dropbox versus going somewhere else. Like, I didn't do any of that analysis, which is extremely unlike my usual or typical framework. But it was exhilarating. And I just knew I wanted to do it. I wanted to try founding my own company and become an entrepreneur. And I said, fine, I'm just gonna dive in. I'm just gonna jump in the deep end of the pool. Let's see what happens. So that's what happened after my Dropbox experience.
Interesting. I was watching an interview the other day with an entrepreneur, and they asked that person, how do you know you're doing the right thing or that you're in the right path? And this person asked, like, there are different steps that I take. The first one is, does this excites me? So you were excited by this idea, right? Yeah. And you
I
take
was,
the, yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
100%. Yeah. I was excited, not I was excited by the idea, the company, the product that we were attempting to build. But what was exciting was jumping into the deep end of the pool, jumping into something unknown. And then all equally exciting, and this is slightly nuanced, knowing that I made the decision, like fully just following my gut instinct versus like this pre-calculated analysis around what should I do, what should I not do. And it was a big life decision. But I knew that if I were going to take it is one of the riskiest things one can do is quitting a job and starting your own company, full stop,
Yes.
right? In any shape or form. It could be the VC-backed tech route where you're swinging for the fences, which is the journey that I've been on. Or even just like, hey, I want to start a side business. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, like some small business. Both are equally exciting. Both take a lot of guts. But like I said, it's exhilarating. It's very exhilarating. And I think and maybe that's something that's innate in people. Maybe it's something that's learned. Maybe that's something that's blossomed, right? Because for me, maybe it is something that just started to grow. I don't think I was born with it necessarily. I was on a very prescribed path, right? There's another alternate life where I'm still at a place like Morgan Stanley and doing my thing, right? But instead, I have this path and it is exciting. It is more exciting. It's more appealing. And I know that I'm doing the right thing when I'm working, quote unquote, but I'm never looking at the clock, right? It just like time just goes. Like I'm in the flow, I'm enjoying myself. That's always been my indicator of, am I enjoying what I'm doing day to day? And is it exciting to me? And if it is exciting to me, then I'm not worried about what time it is. I'm not worried what time I'm gonna have lunch. I'm not worried about what time I need to go home. I'm just in the flow and genuinely and authentically enjoying what I'm doing.
Like how I am right now. Learning and
There you
listening to
go.
your
You're in the
story.
flow.
Yeah,
Yeah.
this is awesome. Ah, great way to put it. Like that's and Unfortunately, not a lot of people gets to feel that way, but we should pursue that, right? Like that you should enjoy what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, 8, 10 hours a day, right? That's a good question to ask to ourselves. Like, are we passionate about what we're doing? That's a very interesting, deep question to ask to ourselves. And so this company is Porter and Sale, right? And how was that journey? So you joined this early stage. You were coming out of Dropbox, early stage, right? 100 people when you joined, very early stage. But you joined this very, like, even earlier stage company. How was that process, Deepak? Share that a little bit more with us.
The process initially was I came on as a contractor just to see how I'd work together with the other co-founders, how the team dynamics were, and it worked out well. And then I said, you know what? If I'm not just going to dip my toes into the pool. I'm just going to jump in. So I jumped in, came in as a co-founder, and spent the next 6, almost 7 years trying to build the company from scratch. And it was quite an experience. Lots of ups, lots of downs. It took us a while to find some sort of product market fit. It took us a while to figure out how to fundraise effectively, efficiently. And this was a travel tech company where our customers were hotels. And you can imagine when we came across the pandemic, hotels were essentially shutting down. Occupancy at hotels globally were at historic lows. So there were a lot of tough decisions. And quite frankly, it wasn't the end of the journey that I would have preferred, but I appreciate the journey because it was an amazing experience with an amazing team. And I wouldn't change anything, right? If you asked me, say, 4 or 5 years ago, while I was going through the depths of the pandemic, trying to figure out how to save a business and travel when no one is traveling, it was quite challenging. And that's a gross understatement, but I wouldn't switch it up for the world. It was an amazing experience. Made a lot of first-time founder mistakes, like a lot, but I've learned from them, and I see it as almost like an education, right? It was like a graduate education, or even it was almost academic in the sense if I kind of look back at it from a retro sort of view. There's a lot that I learned that I've employed into my professional life, but also personal life. So Porter & Sale was a wonderful experience. It was my first time being an entrepreneur, and it was a treasured experience. That's the adjective I'd use.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, just the experience of building a company, I just can't imagine. Can you tell us a little bit more of those mistakes that from which you learn from and those lessons that you learn through this process?
I think there's two that really pop up on my radar. One is that, and this is something, I think gets drilled into entrepreneurs' heads, like don't fall in love with your product, fall in love with what your customer's problem is. And it's something easy to say. I think it's extremely difficult to practice. We had built a product to be used by luxury hotels and their guests, and we fell in love with the product. It was, don't get me wrong, it was a beautiful mobile-based product, very much ahead of its time. This is going back to 2015. And everyone that came across it, big companies, small companies, guests, hotels, thought it was an actually gorgeous product. The problem was that we had a hard time really trying to deliver ROI for hotels, and hotels were the ones paying us. What we didn't realize or didn't take note of is that there were certain parts of the product that hotels did love. There was an upsell platform, for example, that they really enjoyed because we were the ones facilitating hotel room upgrades, hotel room extensions, and really driving actual dollars, more dollars into the hotel. And they loved that aspect. They didn't care how it looked. They didn't care about all the content and production and how beautiful the product was. They just cared that we were driving money, which is 100% makes sense. But I would say our team's focus continued to be on this beautiful product that we were literally in love with. And we did that for so long and tried to force feed the product to clients when clients were actually interested in a different part of the product. And we didn't listen to the customer. We were so in love with our product, we didn't listen to our customers. So that was a huge mistake. And I think really a huge missed opportunity in terms of us capitalizing on growing our business and scaling greater, bigger than we could have. The second thing that I take from that experience is confusing persistence with stubbornness. At the time, I think we told ourselves that, man, we are just persistent. We are going to make this work. We're going to grow this company. We're going to expand the team, expand our clientele. We're going to expand our feature set. We just wanted to keep doing, keep going. But as I look back on it, we disguised stubbornness, meaning we just wanted to do things. We didn't want to listen to the customer. We didn't want to accept that our runway was not clear. We didn't want to accept that investors didn't necessarily want to support us anymore. And we were just persistent, quote unquote, right? We were like, no, we're going to keep going. We're going to make this thing work. We're going to make this thing work. We are entrepreneurs that will, you know, force ourselves onto success. And I can appreciate grit. Like, look, I'm a New York City kid. I started riding the subways when I was very, very young. So I don't know how else did you build grit, right? So it was very gritty, and I appreciate the sentiment. I look back and I think we made a mistake by confusing stubbornness with persistence, and we were stubborn. And I think one must be agile. One must listen to others. One must get guidance from others as well, and know when to accept failure, know when to accept that you're wrong. And I think we masked all of that by telling ourselves that no, we're gritty and we're persistent. We're going to push through. And I think that was a big mistake that I'm trying not to make those mistakes again. Like I mentioned, first time founder mistakes. There, it's real.
Let me see if I got your the phrase that you mentioned word by word. Like, don't fall in love with your product, but listen to what your customers are telling you. That was the
That I mean, that's the old adage that I think everyone said.
old
Please don't
adage.
credit that to me. That's what everyone says. But I do think in practice it's hard to follow, and I think it's a part of your interactions with your team, with customers, with prospects that I even today, you know, this is not my first rodeo, right? And 10 years later, after being an entrepreneur, I still have to like get into that framework for like, no, like. It doesn't matter what I've created, what I've done, what we've done so far. It's actually very egotistical. One has to like let go of the ego around what you've done, what you care about, your baby, quote unquote, right? And really just be an open blank piece of paper to take in what people are telling you, to take
What
in
people are
those
telling
data points and let the data points drive your decision making, right?
you.
That's actually a very difficult exercise to go through. And I think it takes a lot of training and muscle memory to snap back into that mode. And to be fair, I don't think I'm perfect at it at all, even after a decade of this.
Yeah, a lot of flexibility, cognitive flexibility, and humbleness and openness, right? A lot of different skills.
That's exactly.
And yeah, go ahead, please.
No, I was saying your terminology is a lot more elevated than mine. So yes, cognitive flexibilities. I think the way my spouse, who's a psychologist, would definitely term it as well.
Very interesting what is required to become an entrepreneur and to lead a company and build a company. And confusing persistent with stubbornness. What would you say it's a good indicator after all these after this learning path and all these lessons that you have gone through, to knowing when to pivot and knowing when to persist? What would you say in that sense?
Yeah. And perhaps this is my old financial self and investment banking DNA coming in. If it's not working, you got to change something, right? Like, and how do you define working? Revenue. Are people
Revenue.
buying what you're making? Pretty simple. If they're not, then you're not doing something right. So, and don't keep doing what you're doing if it's not working out. And that's stubbornness. That is literally the definition of stubbornness. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, but you're hoping for a different result. Like, that's literally crazy, right? So, no. Are you getting revenue? Are people buying what you're making? Are people like, do they like what you're doing? If the answer is no, and the indicator is dollars, like revenue, this is a for-profit enterprise. If you are creating something and no one is buying it, you're doing something wrong. So switch it up, right? That's actually real persistence. The ability to persist through continuous problem solving. Problem solve where things are not working, switch it up, and then go back at it, right? Persistence is accepting your failure and then getting back up again, right? That's what persistence is. Persistence is not keep doing what you're doing. At least that's the lesson that I've learned. And I think it's definitely worked out. If I think about, you know, the second company, this company, you know, myself and our teams, we just got a lot faster at that, right? And because of that, we accelerated our pace to achieve the milestones of growth and revenue that we wanted. So the data indicates, yeah, the more swifter you are, the more you adopt this type of mentality, it's funny how things then tend to work out at a much quicker pace.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, always always be open to always ask yourself questions, right? Like, is it working? Is revenue coming? Is it increasing? Is the team like getting along? Like, always asking yourself what's going on. But yeah, always be mindful about stuff. Thank you for that, Deepak. So having in mind, continue and accelerating the pace, let's continue with our conversation. What happened? The pandemic arrived. Nobody was traveling. What happened with the company?
Yeah, we had to put our legacy product on hold, right? Like I mentioned, way we drove revenue for our hotel customers around the world was upsells, right? Whether it was extending their stay, room service, upgrading their rooms. But if no one's in the hotel, then there's no opportunities to upsell, right? And that's exactly what happened. So we had to essentially put the legacy product on hold. And then ultimately, we did find a buyer for those assets. And it was by no means an acquisition that made my whole cap table money. We made no ROI on that as entrepreneurs ourselves. But it was the right thing to do because it was dead on arrival in terms of us spinning this business back up again. We didn't know at that time when travel would come back. So we made the best decision that we could then. And that I'm not regretful of. I do believe strongly that it was the right decision. And, you know, there's a few validating points from that. One is, you know, the acquirer is a much larger company. They have about 7 million users. And I see elements of our product in their website and their mobile app. And that's kind of cool that what we created, it's still out there living in some shape or form. And that's really awesome that many people are enjoying it. That gives me some solace. Like, hey, the effort that we put in, it was kind of worth it, regardless of the lack of payoff, right? The second thing is, we canvassed the world for investors. We were lucky enough to get some institutional and corporate backing, a lot of angels, a lot of friends and family, and we knew that we wouldn't be able to make everyone happy. Like, that's just the reality of it. When you have 90 plus folks on your cap table, not everyone's going to be happy. But there was one investor, and she's actually representative of a lot of folks on that cap table, that really understood what we were going through, that this was a black swan event. Things were perhaps, finally going in the right direction. We raised our Series A right before the pandemic. But it didn't work out, and that's okay. And she and another investor as well had shared with me, like, hey, look, you tried your best. That's awesome. First time, it rarely works out. I invested in you because I want to make sure the next time you do something, you're calling me for investment, for funds. This, I see this as a ticket to the next thing that you do. And why that sticks out for me is because at the time, you know, we were so in it. We thought our world was ending when this outcome happened, right, with the company. And but no, it's a long life. Like, it wasn't my only rodeo, right? That was not my first rodeo. Like, that was my first rodeo. It's not my only one, right? So I saw that experience as a singular experience of just this company from start to end. But the investor told one that would be the one that gave me that advice, saying like, no, I'm this is my ticket to punch so I can get into your next company's round because you'll do a much better next time. And that gave me the perspective, like, actually, this is not a singular experience. This is actually a very holistic experience. You know, I'm on my what, technically third company now, but if I fast forward 10, 15 years from now, am I going to start other companies? Yeah, that's definitely not out of the realm of possibility, right? So I it gave me a much more holistic view, which I'm still very appreciative of.
Yes. Wow. You invest in people, not business, right? Huh. Yeah, that resilience. And
Yes.
each time, each company that you're gonna build next, you're bringing all this experience and all this knowledge, and that is invaluable. Like, you cannot learn that by studying and reading books. You can only learn that by going through it. Right.
You gotta learn
That's
by
it.
doing. Yeah. It's gotta be vocational, 100%.
Yeah, love that. Like how this investor just it, like explicitly say that to you. Wow, and very interesting. So, what was the next company? What happened afterwards?
Yeah. So it was actually, I wouldn't say afterwards, it was simultaneous. As this company was winding down and we
Simultaneous.
sold the assets, yeah, we took the very whittled down team. You know, we had to make the hard decisions to lay off about 85%, 90% of the staff, shut down our offices outside of our headquarters here in New York. And we had to literally go back to the drawing board. So what we did was spin up another product that was quote unquote pandemic friendly. And not to get too technical with it, but it was a way to purchase hotel inventory without blackout dates. So it was a glorified gift certificate that was discounted with some of the hotels that we had. And it was pretty novel in the sense that it was we copied our CRM of hotels and the hundreds of thousands of subscribers that in emails that we had and put up a Shopify website in a matter of a week and saw if it worked. And it did work. In a couple months, we were break even. You know, we got to about 1 million in ARR a few months afterwards, so it was working. And then we had the opportunity to sort of roll it up into another competitor, also a small one. Ultimately, we took it. Didn't necessarily work out with a big payoff, like I said, at all. But it was another experience, and it was a lot of lessons learned, and we put them into action. But it was also in the travel tech space. So after that experience, we actually spent some my family and I, my wife, like I mentioned to Iggy, she's from LA. We moved to LA for a couple of years, so it was fun just to kind of like exit myself from travel tech specifically, but then also take a little bit of a breather, especially after going through what, two new companies essentially in the middle of a pandemic. And I always tell folks, it felt like I was selling drugs. And I mean that in the sense that I'm selling something illegal, right? How do you get someone to buy something that's illegal? Like travel literally was restricted. People could not cross borders. Countries were blocking tourists from coming in. And like here I am trying to peddle, like, oh yeah, you should go travel. Like it felt like, okay, is this what selling drugs sells like feels like? Because that's what it feels like. I'm selling something illegal. It's a very difficult thing to do. So anyway, it was very mentally taxing, especially after being an entrepreneur for 7 years for businesses that quite frankly and quite transparently weren't huge successes, right? But it was I see it as a PhD thesis, and you know, much respect to folks that have doctorates. I see why it takes 6, 7, 8 years sometimes to go through that PhD process. And maybe that was my way of earning my ropes, right? In a very vocational sense of, you know, starting a couple of businesses from scratch. So it's like I've mentioned to you before, it was very much an appreciated experience.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that comment. I felt like selling drugs. So funny. But yeah, I can imagine the challenge. That was so funny. How big was the team at Potter Sale? Like at the later at the
At
biggest.
peak,
Yeah, at peak.
yeah, at peak. I mean, we're still a Series A car. At peak, it was around 25 folks or so. But we had a whole
25
horde of
folks.
part-time contractors. Like, oh man, it must have been like maybe 50 to 100 contractors and editors, etc., content contributors. So it was a fairly large network of folks that contributed ultimately to the product.
And what do you look at when you hire someone for your teams?
Great question. I'll give it through the lens of like today, not from the hiring decisions that I've been a part of in the past. Coming incubating Sunrise AI, my latest company out of AI Fund, my hiring approach has been extremely different, right? I actually don't see my role or my task to be hiring for a specific role or mandate. Like, yeah, senior backend engineer, technical co-founder. The technical aptitude and the competence, I think you can find in abundance, right? But there's sort of two specific things I really look for, right? One is what is this per trying to gauge what this person's appetite for like flexibility and change is, right? It really is, does this person adopt the attitude around, hey, I'm working on this, but if the data tells me that we need to switch up, we need to do something completely different, I'm down for it. How do I help? Right? Like that attitude, right? Like knowing that at this early of a stage where we're 0 to 1, we're still pre-product market fit, we're still very much pre-seed stage, pre-revenue. There's a lot that we're in the middle of figuring out, right? Someone told me that the stage that we're in, instead of calling it pre-seed, seed, whatever the terminology is, right? We're in the, and I don't know if I'm allowed to curse here, but like we're in the F around and find out phase, right? That's what we're doing, effing around and finding out, right? And you have to be someone at this early stage who's coming onto your team. There's only a core group of 4 of us right now. They have to be down to F around and find out, right? Like that is the main criteria. Like, yes, there's a lot of talent out there. A lot of people can code, a lot of people can go sell, but the right fit is going to require someone who's down to F around and find out. So that's my one bar. The second thing is, and this is the opposite, I think, of what traditional recruiting questions have come from, right? Meaning, I remember getting hired for my investment banking job. One of the things that, were the criteria, the interviewer would always ask themselves, like, oh, the airport test. I'm not sure if you heard this, Iggy. Like, if you were stuck at an airport with this person waiting for a flight for 4 hours, would you enjoy sitting next to them, right? And that notion never felt right to me, to be honest, right? Because who do I get along with? I get along with my friends. My friends are people that have similar interests to me, right? And that's great. It's great to have colleagues that have similar interests to you. But I also see this from a different lens. Like, I want to be around colleagues, people that I spend around, like, that actually do things, know things that I have no insight or no exposure, I've never experienced of, right? Like, that, how do I learn? And how does the team get better? It's when you're filling in the gaps where people are not similar, where people are diverse in terms of talent and experience, right? That's who I want to, make sure that I'm on a Zoom call with, right? That's who I want to be able to go on a whiteboard and spend 2 hours with, because they're bringing so many other things to the table. So it actually is like, I asked the question, how varied of an experience has this person had from what I know about the world? What lens do they look at the world, and how do they problem solve differently than, say, I'm used to problem solving? That's what I really enjoy doing. And the more different it is from my sort of MO, the more attracted I am to that.
Interesting. Appetite for flexibility and change, diverse group of people. Requires a very specific type of personality to say, yeah, let's join this very risky early stage company and just F around and figure things out and build this from scratch, right? So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for that, Deepak. For those lessons and insights in hiring. Interesting. Yeah,
Of
I'm
course.
gonna apply that for what I do in my interviews searching for startup talent. And really quick before we talk about your current company, what went on between this last company and Sunrise AI? Can you tell us a little bit about that just to have
Yeah.
that in mind?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, I took some time off, moved to LA. But before that, like I started getting involved with I guess a few mercenary activities. I played free agent for a couple different companies. I joined a CPG company out in LA. I started doing some coaching and mentoring on the side for other first-time founders. So it was a whole hodgepodge of activities. But then when I had the opportunity to link up with folks at AI Fund, it seemed like a no-brainer. And this is all pre-ChatGPT fervor, right? This is all before AI became a much more of a household name, right? And it really was an opportunity that I saw that I couldn't resist, right? Obviously, Dr. Andrew Ng, his is a luminary in this space, right? And interacting with this team and knowing what the opportunity was to apply AI and come in as a founder in residence, I saw it. I guess maybe I'm going back to the academic angle. I saw it almost like a an independent study for me to come join the fund, spend some time, have the resources to interact with top tier talent on the AI front. Folks like Carlos, right? Folks like great builders like Catherine, folks that have a great kind of opportunity mindset like Warren, and then linking up with my venture advisor Ross. Like it was an invaluable experience to sort of think through from a white blank sheet paper, hey, what kind of company should we be building? Where are there opportunities? And taking that, I wouldn't even say 0 to 1, -1 to 0, that experience was invaluable. And I was like, look, this is very different from the first couple rounds in terms of starting a company, right? It's a very lonely experience starting a company. It's just you and perhaps a co-founder scratching things out, being in this bubble. But this was the opposite of a lonely experience. And I'd recommend it for any founder, especially serial entrepreneurs. It's a very interesting experience, a very supportive experience and environment in terms of really, really like digging into and accelerating a launch of a company, of a product, of a service. So that was sort of the filler in between the first couple experiences to now what has arisen to be a Sunrise AI.
Yeah, the ecosystem of the AI fund is, it blew my mind the first time I started to meet all the talent, the incredible talent that it has, right? And starting with Andrew, I mean, come on, it's incredible. So
Yeah.
you join from this expression that I love, the negative to zero. And you and now you are the CEO of Sunrise AI. What can you tell us about the company? What is going on right now? What is the stage that the company is right now?
Yeah, we are pre-seed stage. Thankfully we've gotten the support of AI Fund. They are investors coming into our pre-seed round last year. I have a technical co-founder by the name of Shi Palazzolo. We're a fully distributed team, and we have engineers in Detroit and Dallas. We work with a designer in Oakland, so we're fully remote. I'm here in New York, so we cover almost all the time zones here domestically. But what we essentially are is in pre-product market fit mode, right? We're pre-seed. We're trying to F around and find out, like I'd mentioned before. But where we're seeing some grave interest and traction is an interesting space where we can apply AI in better assessing credit and counterparty risk, right? So what does that mean? One's proxy for assessing risk, whether it's on the retail level for individuals with FICO credit scores, for example, or even at a more corporate enterprise level, are my customers going to pay me? What is the risk that my accounts receivables are going to go into bad debt, right? These are all issues that inherently come down to assessing risk. What is the risk that someone owes me money? What's my probability of me getting paid back? It's a very basic question. And we can and have used machine learning models to supercharge the answer of that question, right? What is that? How can we better understand and evaluate that? And where we're finding some interest, and it's super early stage, and we're super interested in continuing to explore this, is on the B2B front. There's a lot of B2B companies out there that have large customer bases where payment risk is an issue, where they don't know if their customers are going to pay them. There's a lot of B2B companies out there where churn risk is an issue. Are these companies going to leave us and we're not going to get paid anymore, right? Are these customers going to leave us and we're not going to get paid anymore? This is I see this as a horizontal application of the product that we built. So we're super excited. We've already been testing this out in a few different verticals. So I'm really excited to see where this lands. But I think the monetization opportunity is wonderful. I think the team that we have is top-notch to make sure that we continue to refine and hone our product. And it's super exciting, again, to be at this 0 to 1 stage, like I mentioned.
And what are you doing differently, Deepak, this time as a CEO in Sunrise AI?
I'll give you a sort of macro kind of mental framework kind of answer, and then I'll give you a more tangible answer to kind of to give it to have a little bit more of a real genuine feel in terms of like how I execute and how I look at my day to day, honestly. So the macro answer is I tend to move just a lot quicker, like way quicker, right? I whether good or bad, you know, because I've always been very cerebral from a quantitative perspective, I used to, I think, have a big tendency to be locked into like analysis paralysis. Like, let's analyze this, let's think about this, let's take a step back, quote unquote, let's figure this out, let's talk this out, let's discuss as a team. And though there are moments that call for that type of approach, but I believe that in an early stage company, like time is your biggest asset. So, you know, this is why startups have an advantage over big corporations, because things take a long time to get done, whereas startups can move super quickly, get insights quickly, and really navigate the field in a much more efficient and clever manner. So I'm very comfortable now, like, great, I'm just going to make an independent decision, and this is what we're going with, right? It's an executive decision. I'm very comfortable doing that. Whereas before, I think I was a lot more leaning towards a consensus-led environment. And number two, that's the kind of shift in the mental framework. The other shift in the mental framework, kind of tangential to this, is the ability to just literally just you make a decision fast, and it might be the wrong one, but that's okay because you're gonna find out a lot more swiftly that it's the wrong decision. Great, let's make another decision. And I'll give you examples of both, right? On the latter, you know, we had a thesis that our product would have a good fit for assessing tenant credit risk, right? So we started going out to landlords, property owners, property managers. We got some traction, we got some customers, we got some tests and POCs done. The product works, but our customer acquisition, the clip, the growth wasn't to where I wanted it to be. It just wasn't fast enough. We weren't necessarily solving a hair on fire problem for these customers. That was us listening to customers. Like, they're not super motivated to want to implement our product. It's not like the holy grail for them. So that's okay. Great. Let's go. There's a lot of other verticals that could use our product. Let's go attack them. So we started listening to the inbound that we were getting, and this is how we sort of further refined our marketing narrative, our narrative around what utility our product ultimately delivers, what value and ROI our product delivers. And that was a quick decision. Great. The other thing, and this is a more execution-oriented version of me versus in previous startups and previous in my previous careers, right? You know, I'm definitely one that has like a long to-do list, and I don't know if I'm old school like that, but I really enjoy like crossing out things that I've done because it's just this feeling that you get like dragging your pen across, like done, done. That and you feel productive, right? However, that doesn't necessarily translate 1 to 1 to productivity, right? Just because you feel productive doesn't always mean that you are actually being productive, right? And what I started to do, and I believe this has helped just us run a lot quicker, is instead of that 20, 30 things of things to do, at the beginning of the week, I and my co-founder and I go to this exercise. We both say, okay, what are the three things that are going to move the needle the most? Right? That's it. And if during the week, these are the only three things that I did, then I'm going to consider this week a win. This was pushing the ball forward. This was moving things forward. This was progress. And these three things probably accounted for like 90% of progress versus the 17 other things that I would have spent my time doing just for the satisfactory feeling of crossing out from the list. Doesn't matter. These are the three things that matter. Just do them. And that's okay. And I started actually siloing or microing that a little bit. And what I mean by that is I'll wake up every day and be like, okay, if I do this one thing today, I'm getting caught up, pulled into many different directions. There's a call here, I'm taking this, like whatever it is. If I just do this one thing today, it's a win. And that has really shifted my way of looking at work, how I approach my day, how I approach my week, and ultimately how I approach every quarter and year and how I build this company. So that mentality shift and the very tangible execution-oriented moves that I've made or changed, I think has really, really been vastly different from my previous professional experiences. And I mean, the verdict's still out, but I do know that we've moved a lot quicker and we're seeing the same amount of success that we're seeing now in just a few months of being out the gates. It took me the first time around, it took us a year, 2 years to get here. So at least the data indicates that it's working, but I'm going to continue to refine and hone this approach. But I know that this is something that I could have only learned after a decade plus of experience.
Well, moving quicker, prioritization. Thank you for that, Deepak. And thank you for everything that you have shared with us. The last question that I have is there anything that you can share with us for what's to come that we should pay attention to?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of fun stuff that Sunrise AI has gotten recognition for here in New York City, from the investment community, from the credit community in the space that we operate in. You know, we're really excited. We're probably going to go public with a couple of big announcements on big customers and brands that we're going to do some work for. So watch out for that. But super excited in terms of what the team has built. I feel grateful every day working with the team that we have. I think we have the best folks around. And it's like you said, it's invigorating, it's exciting. And like I said before, like I know I'm in the right place when I'm not looking at the clock and I'm having tons of fun doing it.
Yes, love how you phrase that. So Deepak, thank you again for your time, for joining me in the podcast. Yeah, love your style, love your communication style. And yeah, we'll be paying attention to what's to come in your career and for Sunrise AI.
I appreciate it, Iggy. Thank you so much. And what you're doing is wonderful, having these conversations. I think it's wonderful to highlight other founders and entrepreneurs. I enjoy it personally. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you again, everyone. Thank you for connecting to this podcast, and see you in the next one. Take care.